Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to a special edition of the tailgate. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Larkin Kemp. Larkin, this is going to be, for many reasons, the weirdest podcast we've recorded. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well.
It was a long off season.
No question. Good to be back. A little bit of a strange one with all the cancellations this weekend, which I think we'll get into in depth, but great to see you in person and good to be here in Foxborough.
That is one of the reasons that this is going to be wild. This is the first in-person podcast we've done. We are at the New England Youth Lacrosse Convention at Gillette Stadium. I arrived alongside probably about 30,000 New England Patriots fans who were sending their team off to the Super Bowl. Not the expected game day environment that the folks at the New England Youth Lacrosse Convention anticipated. As a Baltimore Ravens fan, probably wasn't the start to my Sunday I was hoping for, but on we go.
I grew up a Jets fan, so it's even worse for me.
Wow. We'll talk about the Super Bowl next week. You mentioned it. We're recording on February 1st. It's 1:10 p.m. Eastern, which means that we're not going to be able to talk about Penn State Colgate. We're not going to be able to talk about Syracuse Boston U. And you will be listening to this before the trio of games that, if memory holds, includes Hopkins Robert Morris, Bellarmine Duke, and Iona Hofstra. So we do have some games that we're going to talk about, but we're going to start with the question that has been dominating social media as what was originally supposed to be 18 games on Saturday and 10 games on Sunday became one game on Friday, six on Saturday, five on Sunday, and three on Monday. Larkin, what's going on with these college lacrosse coaches? What are they thinking?
It's brutal, man. I got out of the car today, and it is bone-chilling cold up here. I think, to take a step back, like, what do coaches care about? They want a full week to prep for big games.
That's definitely true.
They want to extend their logistics operations so that they are in control of as very much as they can be, especially those that skew to the high end of RPI and strength of schedule, like on a regression basis. So when you think of an ACC lacrosse coach, like, he is scheduling people for a very specific reason. He is very careful of who he allows to come into town on short rest. He's always going to protect his RPI, as he should, by the way. That's what he gets paid to do, to go to the tournament, to try and win the whole thing. So I don't blame them. I think what we need to be thinking about at 30,000 feet is, like, if we're trying to attract fans, if we're trying to make our product stand out, I think we can all agree that when a United States Military Academy cancels a sporting event, it's pretty eye-popping. And I think it just asks questions about when we should end, when we should start. You know, should we do things to increase, you know, midweek games and shorten rest so that we can have, I think everyone appreciates it. When you go to Hofstra last year and you watch Princeton versus Syracuse, like, that is the sport at its highest level. You know, guys slinging the rock and scoring goals, chest bumps, fist pumps, all the things that we care about. Like, it is freezing out in New England. I don't have an answer. I know it comes down to dollars and cents. I'm sure people caught, the postmortem on Rutgers finances that came out about how much money they've lost since they joined the Big Ten. That's not lacrosse specific, entire department. I think that's a good place to start in terms of, like, there's a lot that goes into these decisions. You know, I'm not at the head of the table, but just hoping for a better product for the fans.
So I wrote in December of 2016 about how interconnected and what the causes of a lot of this are. And so I'm going to push back on a couple things. The first is, I don't think this is an expense-driven issue. I understand that it does cost additional dollars to house sports teams after the academic school year ends, but we're talking about a, you know, either small number of teams or a short duration of time. Not only that, they house their winter sports teams over winter break. That costs money and doesn't seem to cause many problems. And they house fall sport athletes in August before the academic year starts. So these expenses are baked into the experience of hosting these teams. And again, they're not that substantial. I don't think there is very much political capital among the coaches themselves. Lacrosse is still a sport where the schedules are put together by coaches, not by administrators, which is not true, certainly for football and in most instances for basketball as well. And so it's the coach's decision ultimately to A, impose rules around scheduling to which all the participating teams would have to adhere, and B, then subsequently, if not have those rules in place, then make the decisions for themselves. So one of the things that has caused this forward march in the calendar in terms of the volume of games played on the first weekend in February or the second weekend in February has been the sport's progression south. And to the point you just made, I can't criticize John Galloway or Dan Shimani or whomever for wanting to play earlier and take advantage of what their built-in advantages are, which is the weather and the fact that it's easier to practice outside in January and that you get good home games in early February that you might not be able to get in March because you're differentiated in terms of that. So ultimately, where I think it nets out is the point that you made, but it starts with the end of the season and it works forward, not starting from the beginning of the season and working backward. I think the midweek game point is equivalent. The other thing that I would say is the range of how many games you have to play in order to be tournament eligible is too wide. Right now, you need to play at least 11 games, and you can play no more than 17 games. What that means is that you have this huge variance, and what coach... I don't think coaches dislike midweek games. I think they dislike a midweek game where they have 3 days to prep and their opponent has 7 days to prep. That's what they want to avoid. So if you shrink that margin, then the likelihood that everybody is playing a midweek game on the same amount of preparation time goes up. And I think ultimately that's how you see more midweek games in April.
I think that's right. Two other points to call out. Notre Dame playing 11 games this year is a red flag. And what I mean by that is they're one of the best watches in the sport. Like, we want them to play more games. So the question is, how do we get Corrigan to a place where he agrees with that thesis? For now, if he feels like his team's ready, if they go, say, 9-2, they roll through the ACC and they continue to get better every week, maybe in his mind, that's what puts them in their best position to advance in May. So I don't hold that against him. One other call out, just because I have a personal bias towards it, is when you look at the shrinking attendance numbers at Memorial Day weekend, right? You have to at least ask the strategic question of, are we doing the very best thing with how we present our championship product? Baseball, as an example, has created a pilgrimage into the middle of the country. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Omaha, Nebraska. I have. My dad's from there. Other than the fact that they created it, they built it, and they've built a funnel where people fall in love with, like, taking their kids, you know, if their school in the SEC or the ACC make the tournament and they go back and it's a whole thing. You go to the same bars. You have tradition. You build, like, relationships with the hospitality workers there, blah, blah, blah. Is there something like that where we can create that type of ecosystem around in Annapolis or in Balti, around Homewood? I don't know. Ultimately, it comes down to people well above me in dollars and cents. But I think we can probably all agree that it's broken currently. And we want our best teams playing as much as possible against high-level competition, because that's what will turn heads.
In warm weather.
In warm weather or inappropriate facilities where people are enjoying the product. Like, put simply, like, a hockey contest on an ice sheet where the ice is too warm, so the puck is, you know, choppy, that's not good for the product. It's not good for a college lacrosse game to be played in 0 degrees with, you know, negative 20 wind chill. It quite literally is just not how the sticks are built. Like, the mesh, the actual product itself deteriorates. So a lot of questions. Don't think we have answers, but the coaches got to get together. The people who have a voice in this matter and the people who can actually move the product that directions are the ones who are going to have to do it. And by the way, on a net basis year over year, their RPI may take a hit. Like, someone may have to let a team that typically sits 15 to 30 and ultimately represents a trap game come in on a Tuesday in late April before tournament seeding comes out. That's not something that John Donowski or Lars Tiffany or Joe Bresci wants to do, but they may have to. So we'll see.
Were you a latex gloves under the lacrosse gloves guy?
I wasn't. I'm a huge field guy. I'm not a cover guy, as we all know. And the good news is when you're in the rope, you run so much that it never really impacts you. But when you talk to an attackman, you know, who a huge part of their game is, like, feel and placement and accuracy. If the other Fogo goes on a run and you don't touch the rock right. for, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, maybe there's a defensive timeout. Maybe there's a media timeout. Like, it is cold. Like, it's objectively cold. And it impacts the game. So the best players obviously have ways to stay moving and build habits that allow them to not be impacted. And that's all part of the toughness that goes into when you're actually playing. But, like, I don't coach. I don't have to give coach speak. Like, it's just broken. Like, it's not how the game should be observed. So, yeah.
Last one before we get into the games. You mentioned appropriate facilities. Your alma mater just opened a very appropriate facility. Would you like to tout what the Bears have for the future recruits?
Yeah, I'm torn. I'm not a bubble guy, but it's obviously it's really impressive when you have the Walton family, the Penner family backing up what is now the best indoor facility in the Ivy. You know, when I was recruited to Brown, Brown had, you know, bottom of the table facilities. And I went there for different reasons, and I think we're now near the top in our league, if not at the top, and that's obviously very exciting and really excited for them to get their season going, and hopefully we'll be ready to roll here at Fairfield 2 weeks.
So no longer Brown State. You are officially Brown University.
No, we are. But it's a change into the times, and it speaks to, listen, we have to be ready to play, and it's we will now be able to practice deep into the fall and early in the season at the way we should, and that's a huge credit to the administration and the development department for getting that done. And whether I, Larkin, facetiously can joke about the bubble or not, it is what it is, but I know the kids are ecstatic, and it's going to lead to more reps and better development. So
better feel on the lacrosse stick for the attackman if the opposing faceoff guy is having a good day. And that's in practice, so obviously the opposing faceoff guy is your teammate. Let's get into the games. We've got three that we're going to talk about, and then we're going to shift into what is effectively a preseason podcast, because that's more or less where we are currently sitting. Utah 16, Delaware 9. This game was originally scheduled to be played in Newark on Saturday. However, because of all of the aforementioned scheduling, cancellations, postponements, everything else, a very unique twist. Chase Fieldhouse is a full-size indoor facility in Wilmington, about, call it 10 to 15 minutes from Newark. The Blue Hens are able to schedule the game in there Friday, 12:30 p.m. start. The Utes keep their originally scheduled flight into BWI after Thursday practice. They arrive about midnight, head to the hotel, and then opening faceoff is at 10:30 a.m. Mountain Time. As you would expect, based on those factors, the Blue Hens jump out to a 3-0 lead. From that point, it was a combination of the Ryan Steins and Cade Faulkner show as the Utah team that is well known for its play in the middle of the field, its aggressive ride. They caused 8 failed clears. Nico DiPonio is making a name for himself to the extent that he hadn't already. He was the ASUN Defensive Player of the Year. Coach Drew McMahon said postgame that he thinks he's the best defenseman in the country. I believe his numbers were 4 cause turnovers and 6 ground balls. And ultimately, it was a really impressive performance out of a Utah team that lost at home in overtime to this Delaware squad last year after beating Ohio State on the road in their season opener. It really was kind of a momentum-shifting factor in their season as they did not finish with the record that they had, kind of the standard that Utah had set since McMahon arrived. Meanwhile, for Delaware, you know, coming off of a down year by comparison, first year in the A-10, not the start that they wanted to get off to. Any comments on this one?
It's an impressive result for Utah. These two teams I put squarely in the box of ones you always want to keep, you know, an eye on early in the year. They are definitional trap teams. They have the ability to play up to anyone. They're well coached. I think DeLuca is a household name throughout our sport, but when you speak to pros, Team USA type guys, there's a deep level of respect and quality with what he brings to the table. I think maybe mainstream America took notice when they went to Georgetown, right, when Georgetown was highly seeded, and the way he has them prepared to play. So this isn't one where you think they're going to kind of like stumble out of the gate. So what does that mean on the flip side of that argument, right? You know, McMahon takes over. He does very interesting tactical things at Robert Morris. That's ultimately what wins him the job. I think Utah is hard to scheme. I don't think, you know, defensive coordinators and you know, people who run the box sleep comfortably the night before they play Utah. That's a credit to them. You know, people, you know, there's debate on Twitter to the positive that they recruit kind of from everywhere. Like they find guys that are kind of outside of the box and deserve credit for that. And clearly the production's there. I mean, this is not one where they went like 85% at the X or they dominated the goaltending battle and that was the game. Like they kind of just systematically went in there and fundamentally beat them. Like they were drawing leverage. I'm about halfway through the tape, and what I'd say is they did a really good job getting to their strong hands, spinning it and attacking backside. Like it's just kind of rolled the ball out, fundamental offense to the positive. It wasn't, you know, there's two guys who I guess dominated the box score, but ultimately there's a ton of depth production, I thought.
No doubt.
So they deserve credit. And remember with these two groups is these are the types of wins that can really jumpstart a team when, you know, ultimately they have a lesser than schedule and they can get hot. Like they can go on a run, and if they win their conference tournament, you know, be in a position to be a really dangerous kind of bubble seeded type team. So certainly one we're going to have to take notice of heading into to week two and three.
No doubt. Yeah. So you're right that it wasn't a dominating performance at the face-off, but Tyler Klokol did go 61%, so it's worth shouting him out a little bit.
Yep.
But it's also pertinent to note Delaware playing without their number one face-off guy, so that's just a storyline to continue to watch as the year goes along because, you know, they've been a group that traditionally has faced off well. So if that can right-size a little bit, we know, and we will talk about this all season, the compounding nature of winning face-offs. Your offense plays better when they have the ball more. Your defense plays better when they are fresher because they are playing less defense. So it can be, I don't want to call it a cure-all because that probably would be overstating it, but it can be the ointment that affects like all the different areas of the field that fall 10% short, 15% short, whatever the case might be. The last thing I want to say about this game this is not inside lacrosse patting ourselves on the back. This is exclusively, explicitly a good job, Kevin Brown. Because of the late relocation for this game, there was no streaming option. We have, as a sport, consistently been in a situation when the first game of the season was not streamed or there was no plan to stream it on two occasions, including in 2021. So the first game after COVID, Bellarmine went to Mercer. That was the first game of the season for whatever reason. Started at 11 a.m. Every other game on that Saturday started at noon, whatever the case might be. And it wasn't until very late in the game, and by in the game, I mean leading up to the game, that Scorebreak stepped in and created a streaming option that people were able to watch. No such option emerges here. Kevin Brown standing on the end line, because that was the only available space for media to watch, holds his phone up and streams via Twitter. I know he went half, quarter, quarter, so we don't have like a total number of watchers, but I believe it was definitely over 5,000 for the first half. Shout out to Kevin for the arm strength in order to be able to keep your phone locked on the action and provide some high quality entertainment wise, at least commentary throughout the game. So definitely satisfied a lot of lacrosse fans' appetite for lunchtime Friday lacrosse. Keeping it moving, Army UMass. This is one of the more traditional early season matchups. It's been one-sided in favor of the Black Knights over the course of the last decade or so. But as you pointed out when we were, you know, talking about this ahead of recording, a lot of these games had been really close. Not this one. Army 14, UMass 8. This game played in West Point, again inside. Alex Schoen on the broadcast call. And, you know, once again, a kind of jaw-dropping performance leading the way, this time from Hill Plunkett, who had been playing midfield, switches back to attack in the wake of the graduation of Jackson Eicher, and paired with Braden Fountain to just put up pretty substantial numbers for the Black Knights offensively. But what was interesting for me was that this game started really slow from a goal-scoring standpoint. For UMass, it was Owen Salinger. For Army, it was Sean Byrne. And they both set the tone for, typically, the reputation is that it's hard to play goalie inside. Not the case early on in this one. Both guys finished over 50%. Obviously, Byrne with a really impressive day, keeping UMass to 8 goals. Larkin, you know, this was a big result, again, specifically for New England and the way in which regionally some of the power structure comes together. What were your thoughts on Joe Alberici's squad's win?
This is one I had circled to watch, and I did, for a couple reasons. You know, Greg Cannella, I think, is one of the most underappreciated coaches, both with respect to his tenure, what he did at UMass, but also just under-resourced in a sport where a lot of kids, you know, skew, let's call it educational aspiration, perhaps a little bit harder to attract some of those guys from prep or Balti or whatever. He's always just been rock solid. So I was genuinely just curious to what they would look like post him. And obviously by, you know, handpicking his successor and going with an alum and someone who's coached there, there's a lot less friction and a lot less change, let's call it culturally. But I wanted to see what UMass, you know, would look like. And with Wardo moving on to Loyola and just so much top end, let's call it loss on the senior side from Army. I mean, it's a different group. Like, I think Plunkett's really good. I thought with their attack depth last year, he was a really, you know, light switch type trigger out of the midfield, attacking short six out of spinning rotations. I thought he looked unbelievable when they beat up on Yale. I got to watch that one in full. So I think Army's solid. I do think that they have to find some pieces, and for Army to take a step this year, they're going to need some poles that not many people have heard of, let's call it,
right,
to develop top end. Candidly, and this is a little bit less in terms of like headline flashiness, I actually just thought the help recover in this game was not great. Like, I didn't think UMass was ready to play in terms of slide recover, and they'll get better. Like, I'm in no way putting that on anyone. It's early. It's week one. You know, as we all know, attackmen and people who lead the team in scoring get the headlines and the recognition in this sport. But this is one of those very unique sports where depth midfielders attack short sticks like late in games. That is actually how college lacrosse games are won. It's very different from basketball that way, when the All-American has the ball in his hand at the top of the key and he's attacking the screen. Very, very often the All-American attacker is standing below GLE. And, you know, midfielders that perhaps people haven't heard of are kind of triggering the possession. So that's how this game has always been defined for me. I think it's probably the best week one game annually, just in terms of like high level product. It always feels like a rock fight, even when the score doesn't represent that. And I'm not counting either of these groups out. So it'll be one we'll have to continue to watch.
Shout out Jack Tarowski, the UMass offensive player, 5 goals and an assist, exceeding his point total from last year in total, in the first half, not even in the total, in the full game. So to your point, the Kyle Smith era now underway. I want to echo your point about Greg Cannella and really underline the manner and timing with which he announced his retirement, which was August. This was a rumor that had been circulating over the course of the entire summer, but it wasn't until far beyond the typical hiring season, so to speak, that ultimately it came to fruition. And I think that there were a lot of internal mechanics that led to that, and I think they all point to the combination of respect and credibility that Greg Cannella had internally within that UMass community, the UMass athletic department, that it was able to unfold the way that it did. And I think that his endorsement of Kyle is worth a lot. And to your point, the manner and way in which and speed with which they improve over the course of the season will be very telling. Last one we're going to talk about, Rutgers 11, Jacksonville 10. This one played in Naples, Florida, the Paradise Sports Complex. A back-and-forth game that featured 4 ties and 2 lead changes. The Scarlet Knights emerging on top thanks to Colin Kelly's overtime game-winning goal. The knowns were really impressive for Rutgers, and that certainly starts with Colin Cardilla and Carden Stoller in goal. For Jacksonville, it, you know, certainly is a stinging loss, but a lot of positives to be taken away. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I watched this one in full. I was a little bit surprised at times. This is one where I thought Rutgers would cover. I thought they came on late in the season last year, a couple big results down the stretch in the Big Ten. I obviously respect John Galloway, both as a player and a coach. I think he's doing a great job at Jacksonville and deserves to get a look for a big-time job when it does come up. But ultimately, this is one where Rutgers let him hang around, and Jacksonville had a couple of chances late, you know, to win a clamp, get a ground ball, and get their ball back to the offense and potentially have a chance to win this thing. Credit to the big right-hander late. I've never understood when defenses don't slide in overtime. Like, trust your training, bump and recover, U-turn, like, make them string passes. I don't really get letting the big boy get right on that. But both goalies were great. The stream was a little bit hectic. I think we all worked through that. But I give Brian Breck credit. Like, that's not a game he has to schedule. You know, heading south.
It was a game that looked very smart for scheduling, as everybody else got wiped out by weather as the week went along.
Right. But it's a trap game. Like, that's a Big Ten team that does not want to lose to a non-power conference, or, you know, whatever the appropriate framing is. And Jacksonville's scrappy. They're hard to scout. They're scrappy. They're rope solid. But Rutgers, you know, ultimately down the stretch, like, they did what they needed to do. And this is one that right now looks just lukewarm. But listen, they survived. And I think a lot of their, you know, depth midfielders got important minutes. I thought the knowns, when they needed him to, found a way to get the ball by what was a hot goalie. And he was flopping really well. Like, everything in tranny and everything low, he was eating up with his feet.
17 saves for Ryan De La Roca.
And many, in my opinion, were high-end. Like, yeah. He played well. He gave him a shot. I think JT, or, you know, I know JT's there now, Giles, or whoever's running the D for John, I think they'll want a few front-end slides back. Like, they got caught up a few times getting beat on what is, like, a high-screen slip to the midfielder, where, like, that has to be rotated to, and we have to force Rutgers to get it to the backside. So they're probably kicking themselves, but that's early season lacrosse. Like, both these teams have many games to play where they can get where they want to. Especially Jacksonville being in the conference they are, you know, a lot of this early season muck comes down to just, like, getting their product to a point where they can try and win their conference tournament.
I want to dig in a little bit on the not sliding in overtime. I want to start in this particular instance because. So as a long stick midi, you were probably in the slide decision position for a right-handed attackman coming up the hash in a decreasing shooting angle position where, to me, so many different things can be going on. So number one, I would imagine that while you have a principle of coming from the crease or coming adjacent, there are probably some defensive alignments where it changes, right? When you get beyond 10 yards above GLE.
Yep.
The second is the timing of the slide. Also, one of the things that makes the decision on whether or not to slide challenging is, am I going to slide to the right spot? Because there is a possibility that he's going to curl in. Yep. And there's a possibility that he's going to continue upfield, and I might be creating offense for them by sliding. So just talk a little bit about that area on the field and what it typically means for – who's making the decision, right? Yep. So is it a goalie called slide, or is it going to be a defensive called slide? And then how you typically want to U-turn and recover in that scenario?
Yeah, so the reason offensive coordinators consistently press the low wing, both by starting sub-GLE and going north and vice versa, is that by definition, let's call it 95% of college defenses, you're going to actually change who's slide hot.
Okay.
Right, so you're going to go from a coma.
While the dodge is happening,
you're going to go from coma low pipe help to what is effectively whoever's in the center. They could be open. They could have two, right? They could have one.
Right.
Typically, it will be the LSM pulls himself out, especially in OT, because he's going to want to be fire hot. I think
because you know that you're not going to get shot through the way that a short stick might.
Both because you ultimately want the re-dodge to be into your six-foot pole, okay, if you could choose. And second, because you feel comfortable with your own pacing and decision of, like, when to go and also how to bump the recovery. Like, you're very comfortable. The reason an LSM plays is not because he can cover, even though that's, like, how All-American voting happens. It's because he can communicate. Like, he can pull in the backside and communicate when we're changing from low fill to high fill and vice versa. But what it comes down to for me, and maybe this is just a personal preference, but I just want to be on my toes, not my heels in OT. And ultimately, like, I don't want the game to come down to a re-dodge no man's land decision where you leave your goalie on an island. Like, I personally would have fired. I would have played it differently if I was the cover pull. So I never would have allowed him to get topside righty. But, like, college defenses are built to be able to bump and recover to the backside and to reslide. So, like, that's not a thesis break. It's amazing how consistently you see it.
So a broader point to your comments about Rutgers, I've talked about my process for preparing for the season, creating preseason content. And I have this big spreadsheet that includes, like, all the numeric metrics for each team on the left side. And then all the columns from a certain point over are who you lost, seniors, juniors and sophomore contributors, returns, transfer arrivals, freshmen. And just the visualization of it can be really useful when it comes to getting a better sense for what teams lost and what they bring back. And when I was looking at it around Christmas, so effectively the second time, right? I do this before fall ball, and then do it again during, like after fall ball, and incorporate the lessons learned from fall ball into some of the additional content that gets created. I realized, I was like, man, I'm a little lower on Rutgers than their visualization suggests. Like, they on paper look better than I realized in terms of the amount that they're bringing back. However, there are still a ton of question marks, and it's very unclear how these pieces fit. And I want to bring it up just to say that last year, one of the things that I heard from folks that were around Rutgers was just the importance of Colin Kelly. And I was just, it sounded a little head scratching because it was a Canisius transfer. And you're like, are we sure that he's going to level up? But the point was, the size and physicality had proof of concept with Mitch Bartolo when he came over from Penn and was so effective as a 6'6 shooter. And the idea was that Kelly was going to be able to do that for this team as well. And, you know, one game in, that proved to be an apt comment. So just a lot to parse out, a lot to gel together when it comes to that.
Yeah, Rutgers staff deserves some credit. Like, they have built a reputation of at least being competitive with Tillman's Maryland in a very tough conference late into April. Like, they beat them last year, wins against Michigan and Hop, right? Even in a down season, that's nothing to sneeze at. And when you watch them on film, they don't jump. Like, there's no sub-GLE attacker that's going to be voted a first or second team All-American, right? So they're going to have to win it the old-fashioned way, like 8-7 in a rock fight. So we'll see. It's just one we'll have to monitor.
Before we transition to the preseason podcast portion of this, just a couple of quick updates to give you some context. Penn State up 15-11 over Colgate with 2 minutes to play in the third quarter, and Cuse up 4-2 on Boston U early in the second. Let's see what Joey Spillane has got. He's got a goal. Four different goal scorers for the Orange and two different goal scorers for the Terriers.
Do we know if Aquino started at attack?
He did, okay. But he wasn't really occupying very much space in a traditional attack spot. He was really going back to that. He was actually initiating a lot from the high lefty wing and carrying into the middle of the field based on what I was able to watch before we started. All right. I have a thesis for the season, and you probably know what it is if you're listening to this podcast because it was legitimately just the cover of our face-off yearbook. But before we get into that, Larkin, do you have like an overarching thesis for this campaign?
Well, you've led me to water slightly because I know what yours is, so I don't want to duplicate.
All right, well then let me just say it.
Yeah, and then we can rip off it. Sure.
So my first season covering lacrosse full-time was 2008, which means that this would be season number 19 for me. This is the most wide open any season has been out of those 19 years. And one layer on top of that, the reason is because, and in some ways this is going to be a little salt in the woundish for you, and in other ways it's going to reinforce the style of play that you occupied. While the adage is defense wins championships, that is not true in lacrosse. Offense wins championships, and specifically returning offense experience is what wins in May. There is less offense experience returning in this aggregate of national championship contending teams relative to any year that I can recall. And that is why, to me, those two points go hand in hand.
I agree. I think, like, when I was driving up here, I was thinking back to last season. I listened to the Top 50 Player podcast that you guys did as a way to refresh my memory on some of the kind of losses versus returning retention and point production. Ultimately, I think people immediately, because of recency bias, will default to say, well, Maryland's compelling because of Tillman, right? I actually think of the last, let's call it 10 years, this is maybe the least interesting Maryland offense. Right. So, yes, do they have Lyons and Johnson? And is that an interesting insertion of Ivy League profession? I guess. Yeah, it is on paper. But I love their defense. I've loved their defense every year for the last 20. Right. So, okay, now we take a step back. If they're not like a headline, massive Vegas favorite, Princeton's really interesting. But Princeton hasn't had championship week in production in a long time, and they'll have to prove themselves. And I also think McAsee was the heart and soul of that team.
Sure.
I think that the public is way higher on Cornell. I love Buse. I think he's a stud. Obviously, that's tough for me because, you know, I played at a league rival and I want Brown to be successful. I also think CJ Kearse is maybe one of the best lefties and ultimately college lacrosse players of the last 50 years. Like, he's not only good, he's generationally good. And yep.
And also, to your Coulter Magazine point, was very clearly, if not the heart and soul, then certainly the smile and energy bus for that team.
And not to – I actually love this kid's game, so in no way do I want to throw shade. But just to call this out, Ryan Goldstein's been voted, I think, a top seven player in the country by the Inside Lacrosse staff. People just genuinely don't realize how much attention the defense was giving CJ Kearse and how dramatically different Goldstein's life is about to become.
It's going to be the equivalent of what happened to McCabe Millen between 2024 and 2025.
Correct. The hardest jump in lacrosse is when you go from a third, you know, production level attackman who's effectively like a nobody on paper in comparison to the amount of time the defensive staff is planning and preparing for the front side help to the lefty half wall in Kearse's perspective, or to X during the Jordan Wolf days, or to, you know, Sergio Perkovic out of the right-handed alley, right? It's like the definition of coaching defense at this level is, okay, what are the knowns? And how do we want to decide what we're going to give up? How do we want them to try and beat us, right? So that's just an example. Like, I think Goldstein and Firth are fantastic. I think Kearse was unbelievable. So I think Cornell's offense will not look the same. That's how I feel.
Agreed.
So I think the point around, could this be a year where someone gets hot and, you know, a team that has not been to an Elite Eight or a Final Four in 20 years perhaps has a chance. I know everyone's focused on Richmond. I would argue there's far more teams in that equation.
Totally.
And, you know, whether it be Michigan or Hop or whoever, like, this is definitely a year where there could be someone that is shocking to the current pundits. I think that's what makes it so exciting. Like, I think, to use personal example, I think it was fun for the world when, like, Brown played Navy in a quarters, right?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Tell us about the 2015 Brown team season. Where'd you guys finish? And what do you remember about the way in which you guys were regarded in the preseason heading into 16?
Yeah, I remember, you know, we felt like we were pretty good. We had a result that really hurt us in the RPI, and we were actually bubble out in most forecasts of the bracket.
In 15.
Yeah. And we got in over Princeton because we had a head-to-head win in New Jersey. And huge thanks to whoever was running the committee that year. I don't think it was Donna, whoever Osella doesn't like.
It was definitely not.
But they sent us to Bill Tierney's and Westberg's Denver team. And that's obviously a super tough draw. So we got beat up in the first round pretty handily. I mean, that offense was unbelievable. It was like Berge, Zach Miller.
They won the championship.
We were competitive, but we didn't, you know, we weren't really ready to play, whatever. But we had a lot of returning pieces. And I also think.
Was that a really, like, thunderstorm disrupted game?
No, that was – the longest lacrosse game ever played was we played UVA in Atlanta, and it was like 8 hours. There was five different lightning delays. It was insane.
Oh, that was when it was like fifth place
– Dom's last season.
ACC situation.
Yeah, exactly. We were like the sixth team. But I think coming back in 16, and then we can get off my personal experience, but I thought the world didn't realize how good a John Yazzo Scaparata or a Will Garal or even an Alec Toledo as an example. Like, we had a true cover one that no one had really heard of. And Kel was the best goalie in the world, and I think most people kind of still thought he was like an honorable mention type.
Right.
So there are teams like that out there right now that have super high-end production that are being undervalued just because, for whatever reason, they, you know, lost a one-goal game last year, and because of that, like, the whole world, you know, turned off the film on them. But you look at a UNC as an example. Ton of talent, ton of pressure, by the way, on that staff. I think the whole world knows that. Can they deliver? Can Owen Duffy deliver on the promise of becoming the next, like, Long Island sensation below GLE that the whole world knows about? I think the expectation for him and Dom is like 100 points a pop here in a league that's pretty wide open. So that's just one example. But there's guys like that everywhere.
So let's just zero in on Carolina for a second, because I totally agree with the knowns that they have at attack are about as good as anybody in the country. But they're going to have, at the very least, two sophomores on their first midfield line and then a three freshman second midfield line. The hardest jump to make in from high school to college across is at the midfield. And they've got five underclassmen in their top six. Their top two midfield lines. It just strikes me as, like, that's really hard to win with. And I have them number four. Like, for me, they're a very solid number four. I think what I just said illustrates exactly how many question marks there are out there, because those are huge question marks for the Tar Heels.
Totally. Completely agreed. If you have three midfield lines, you have no midfield lines. The only staff that's ever won with that level of midfield production is Duke. I don't know why they play so many people. Like in the Jonesy class years, I feel like they were kind of rotating lines late. Credit to them. I wouldn't play that way. There's a reason, you know, every professional lacrosse team just keeps running out Tom Schreiber.
Right.
Like it's not, you know, they're fit. They can do it. But yeah, it's really fascinating. And now the flip side of that argument is when it's so wide open, you bet on the knowns. Like you invest in your circle of competence. Like, do we actually think John Tillman won't be there on Memorial Day?
Right. I mean, right? Yeah. No, and not only that, but also to that point,
right.
if you don't know, then bet on the known.
Correct. But I also think, just to spin it as something to kind of get people excited, it also makes it really compelling. There's a lot of great staffs out there that have kind of been bumping along, going through, let's call it like a talent reload. Like Matt Brown's a great lacrosse coach. Can he get Denver going this year? There's a ton of pressure, obviously, on Coach Millman at Hop just because it's Hop. Like, if you were going to build a potential scenario for Syracuse to run the table and get back to where that fan base wants them to go, this is a year where there's a lot less talent at the top, right, in the sense of like known production. You don't have to go through Schellenberger and O'Neill and all these guys who have massive brands and have been there. Now, the flip side of that argument is then the pressure builds. Then it's like, okay, now the world thinks Joey Spillane is the number one player in the country, right? Do I? No, I would have voted a poll. I would probably say Will Schaller. I also think
that was a fist bump for the non-visual watchers.
Yeah. Listeners. And by the way, it's not just because I'm a defenseman. Like, I think that we need to normalize the notion that like a Tour of Time finalist can be a do-it-all defenseman. And Dominican Sue should have won the Heisman. Right? And it shouldn't have to be a goal-scoring LSM. Like, you should be able to be an elite, all-inclusive 6v6 cover D, who also fills well. But anyways, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think Ohio State's super compelling. I think a lot of people will get excited about that. I don't know if they have enough on offense yet. They definitely have enough on the back end and in Cage. So they're certainly going to be interesting. I think people are very interested by Penn State. But I really do think, I think Princeton, this is a year to watch for them.
Is there one thing about this year that you are particularly excited for?
I'm just excited like to be back on the East Coast. I think everyone knows how much I love the sport. You know, my weekends are now free in the sense that I'm not involved with any program, so I can get back to going to Brown games and being, you know, chief tailgate officer and like focusing on pulling the rope there, but also just to be able to watch film and get back to like traveling to some of the great venues in our sport. Like I'm gonna try and get on the road and go to Balti at least once this year, see a game at Homewood, try and catch something up in Boston for sure. I'm just excited to see the freshmen and sophomores that we've never heard of who become the next kind of like guy.
So are you prepared to answer a question that I've asked you for months at this point, which is the chief tailgate officer committing to the tailgate podcast for the 2026 season?
Put me on the spot for sure.
It literally is in the rundown.
Yeah. I will be recurring. I'll be a recurring guest, and by that, I think I'm going to try and do it weekly.
There you go. There we go.
Obviously, work comes first. And yeah, but
we probably should have told the audience before. Like really, like the first thing is that Nick Acello is just not on this podcast because he's not with us in New England because he was calling the San Diego Seals game last night.
Yeah.
He is not on the podcast.
He's not currently here.
He's just not here.
Either that or he's just sitting at the end of the table, hungover. But,
correct. So just because we're in the housekeeping section and we're going to get to predictions here to finish up. First things first, I don't know why I said it that way. There's a new version of InsideLacrosse.com. I am very pleased with its current – no, it would be too strong to say I'm very pleased with its current format. I am pleased with where we currently sit. I am very pleased at the progress we have made since January 7th when we launched the new version. And that is the important point, which is the amount of new features that are going to be added on an hourly and daily basis here over the next several weeks and months is going to be really substantial. What you see on the front end is only a portion of it. What we are dealing with on the back end in terms of new tools is probably 50% of all of the work that it is done to get to that point. And I want to shout out Mike Gilbert, Patrick McEwen, and Wes Kraft for all of the effort and elbow grease that they put in to get us to this point. I also want to say that we want your feedback. This morning when I was on my way here, heard from Jody Simone, the founder of Lacrosse Unlimited. He really wants basically what we would call continuous scroll, which is, all right, so if you go to the scoreboard page, you see today's games. He wants to be able to scroll down and see yesterday's games. I totally agree. That's on the to-do list. We'll get there. Paul Carcaterra, he's like, he was like, I was a ninja with the player stats. And I'm like, we got to build the player roster scraping tool. Once we do that, we're going to get player stats back, and we're going to take that even to the next level when it comes to some of the advanced analytics. So point is, if you've got something that you want to see on the website, let us know. It is probable that it's already on our radar, and we're going to get there hopefully sooner rather than later. But number one, it's always nice to know the stuff that people really like and really use a lot. So for instance, when we flipped over, the thing that we heard the most about was the absence of the chronological commitment list. That is the first non-college scoreboard thing on the to-do list that will come back as soon as possible. But it's not just about the features that you like. It's also, oh, we didn't really consider that. Like, it might not have been on our radar, and so there's always a lot of benefits in telling us what you like. If you listen to this, you probably know how to get in touch with me. But hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. Email me, tfoyd@insidelacrosse.com. Always want to hear from you. Larkin, let's bring this down with predictions. Who do you got in the Final Four?
Ooh. I think the known is Maryland. I think Maryland will be there as the one seed probably. I just don't see a world in which, with the quality of that defense, they are not in every ball game they play. With their strength of schedule, they will be a seeded team come the first round. And I think with Tillman's experience, how can you bet against them? I think Princeton, obviously I want Brown to be successful. I think Princeton was going to win the Ivy. Pete Bonanno is my breakout player of the year. It quite literally breaks my heart he doesn't wear Brown on Saturdays, but his dad's a dear friend. I love watching him play. I thought he was the best offensive trigger player in that quarterfinal matchup, and I expect him to support Mackesy's production in a way that will surprise people on the left side. So I think those two I feel fairly confident in. From there, I actually think it's wide open. So I think the world wants me to say Cuse. I think people dramatically underestimate how good Owen Hiltz was. I think that they had two poles. The transfer from D3, can you help me with his name?
Michael Grace,
RIT. Canadian type Pro. Of guy who's going to play in a World Games that not many probably mainstream Americans have heard of. They need saves, and there's a ton of pressure on them. It's still really hard to go to the Dome and win. I expect them to be a seeded team come May, but I'm not a hater. I think Joyce Boone is an incredible player, but I'm not going to just pencil them into championship weekend. They lost some real talent. I think if Duffy's as good as people think, then UNC should be there. They haven't played good defense in a decade. So it's not as easy as, when you have a known such as the culture of Maryland's defense, you can kind of just assume that a bunch of poles that not many people have heard of are going to bump and recover at a level that can get there. But I think those are probably the two that most people would put. Do I want to do that? I don't think I do. I'm going to go Maryland, Princeton as the one and the two seed. I think Duke is like a 7 or 8 seed and wins a quarterfinal matchup. So I'm going to give them credit. I think McGuire's a stud. I think Johnson can cover. I think Danowski's earned the respect to expect that he can kind of in this type of muddy year maybe get there. And I'll go UNC as a 3 seed, gets an easier track than they probably should, and beats the Patriot League champ in the quarters.
So I did go Maryland, Princeton, Syracuse, and Richmond. I have been asked to predict I've done a ton of Syracuse preseason radio, TV, whatever, and they keep asking about the distinction between a Final Four pick and a champion pick. And this is something that I to say I learned it from you might be a little too strong. To say that I have kept it very top of mind because of the points that you make is absolutely fair and accurate, which is you can make an argument for the Final Four teams on the basis of the quality. I think that it's very hard to predict a champion on the basis of quality. Champions win disproportionately on the basis of matchups. And as annoying as this is, who plays first and who plays second on Saturday?
100%.
And we don't know that until the bracket comes out. So I am going to go with the Terps as my champion. Who's your champ?
Terps. In a 7-5, like, slug, you know, Big Ten football style slugfest.
And maybe they'll get the first game on Saturday. I'm going to go with Joey Spolina for my Twarton winner. He is the ultimate floor raiser, and I think his production is going to be there. I think Syracuse's team success is going to be there, and I don't think anybody is going to outflank him from the standpoint of either production or team success.
I think that because of how long it's been since Princeton has been in the spotlight, similar to Dylan winning in 16, even with us not winning at all, I think Kabiri wins the Twarton when they get a 1 or a 2 seed.
All right, before we bring this inaugural opening season opening podcast down, we're going to go ahead and get Lars Kiel up here on the podcast. I don't even know what your title is other than Jedi.
Program director.
Program director for Mass Youth Lacrosse.
Alpha.
You're the reason that we are here. You go a ways back with Larkin.
I did.
Coach this guy. That one year when the stars aligned.
We talked about that at the beginning of the podcast because they're potentially a good illustration of going from one level to the next.
Mm-hmm.
How? Tell us a little bit about this event here we've got going on at Gillette Stadium.
This is year 4 of the New England Youth Lacrosse Convention powered by Mass Youth Lax. We're, you know, in the years after LaxCon, kind of, you know, with COVID happening and just LaxCon going down, there's just kind of a void that kind of needed to be filled. And it's just our organization, like, we've more than doubled in the last 5 years. And now we have over 100 boys programs, over 100 girls programs for like 130 plus unique towns in the state. And we actively try to make sure that we're providing a resource for all these towns. Like, one of the things that we really pride ourselves on is our coaching education. So this event, not only are we trying to put it on for anyone, we try to have programming for kids. We try to have, you know, something that parents can come to and gain out of it. But also, like, this counts as one of our coaching education requirements for our coaches. So if you want to be a certified coach in the MYL, you have to come to one of these events every other year. So when it comes down to it, sometimes people get it's tough with schedules, but we try to. I mean, we have 16 or 17 of these that we have all over Eastern Mass throughout the year. We just partnered with Maine. We're helping, you know, bringing a number of the towns in Maine under our umbrella. So I was really happy that I saw a bunch of town directors from the state of Maine who came down here for the day. So,
it's a pretty incredible event. Thousands of people here, really impressed by the quality of top-level coaches and minds in the sport. And I'm sure they're sharing a ton of knowledge on an individual and fundamental level through workshops and things like that. So credit to you guys.
And you got to send the Patriots off to the Super Bowl.
Well, you know what? We talked to the craft group. We were able we allowed them to put that into our schedule today.
Yeah.
All right, Lars, really appreciate it. Thanks so much for having us. And to our listeners, thank you so much for checking out this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We'll be back next week with more tailgate, including Larkin Kemp and Nick Osello. And we'll be back with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast later in the week. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. Thank you, guys.
Go Brill.